Made possible in part by Ratio Architects, designers and planners, dedicated to distinctive projects for community, life sciences, and workplace clients. On the web at www.ratioarchitects.com.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. I'm Jeff Bostert, sitting in for Celeste Quinn. Our producer is Harriet Williamson. The technical director this afternoon is Jason Croft. Our guest this afternoon is Mike Veck. He's the owner and operator of six minor league baseball teams. Mr. Veck has taken in his experience from the front office and incorporated what his father showed him and compiled it into a book entitled Fun is Good, How to Create Joy and Passion in Your Workplace and Career. Mike, maybe better known as the son of Bill Veck, who ran major league teams from the 1940s into the 1980s, including two bouts owning the Chicago White Sox. Mike's father was also well known for various promotions surrounding the game, including the exploding scoreboard at the old Comiskey Park, as well as sending up midget Eddie Goodell to bat in a St. Louis Browns game many years ago. Although Mike says he didn't intend it, he followed in his father's footsteps at the minor league level, not by just incorporating a lot of promotions at the minor league games, but simply making an atmosphere, he says, that allows coworkers to love work, which he says results in a more productive environment. Good afternoon, Mike Veck.
Good afternoon to you. I love the use of two bouts with the White Sox.
Well, I think I created that one. A lot of this came out of, you know, doing my web research, et cetera. But what led to the decision to, why did you feel this book was important? And did someone talk you into it? Or did you think this was finally a good thing to do after so many years with this minor league group?
Well, actually, you know, everybody always says, gosh, I'm going to write a book. And in 1999, after my 7-month stint with the Devil Rays, which was my second of 4 trips to the big leagues, I was making a speech. And Pete Williams, my co-author, heard it and came up afterwards and said, you know, that would be kind of interesting. That would make a book. And, of course, I said, thank you very much. You're flattered. And, of course, everybody's got a book. And you go on about your business. And we did do a sample chapter a year later, and Rodale Publishing said that they would like to have it as long as it used baseball as the backdrop and a business book format. And so that's kind of how it was born.
Well, it's a real easy read. And when you look at it, initially you think minor league baseball. Well, of course that's fun. How did you go about writing something that would apply to, you know, almost any kind of workplace?
Well, in 1991, after operating a couple of minor league teams and a stint of 6 years in the major leagues, we were going to start an independent league in the upper Midwest, and specifically for us in St. Paul. And I wrote a marketing plan because the pundits all said at that point that independent baseball had disappeared from the landscape, hadn't been around with the advent of affiliated ball, which simply means that you have a parent club that watches over 6 of your minor league teams, and or that's an average number. So the first 3 words of the marketing plan were fun is good, and I had nothing else except that. And the opening night in St. Paul, we hung up a sign that said, fun is good, someone stole it. And the second night, we hung up another sign with a particular typeface, and they stole that. And the third night, we rolled out a line of hats and shirts. And it was kind of funny, and we had a great deal of fun with it. And it was the beginning of a 17-page marketing plan. But underneath, there was kind of a sadness to it, a bittersweet, that people needed signage to remind them to have fun. And that's when it dawned on me that this is applicable to any startup business, to any business that exists that you think should run smoother, better, more efficiently, and improve the bottom line. And so I kept a file, and I just would throw in little ideas or little things that we tried or friends of mine had utilized that worked, and that's how we assembled all the material.
I'd like to pause here and remind listeners that you can call in with a question for Mike Veck. Perhaps you'd like to know how his practices might apply to your business. Our numbers are 333-9455 or in and around Champaign-Urbana. And for anyone else that can hear us, the toll-free number is 800-222-9455. Some additional incentive for anyone wanting to call in with a question. We'll be giving away two copies of the book, Fun is Good, today to listeners who call in with questions. Tell me a bit, Mr. Beck, about just the everyday atmosphere at your office. What's a typical day like? I read about you and your minor league promotions and some of your ideas, but of course there's a lot of work to do as well.
Well, I mean, you look at it across the landscape of a day at work, and the fact that you end up playing a ball game actually is one of the shortest parts of the day. So what you deal with, Jeff, are 15-hour days. Homestands can run 6, 7, as long as 10 games, as we're currently running in St. Paul. And you need to keep things light because the second shift, of which there isn't any really, begins when most people start to come in the gates. And so during the morning, you have the pressures of getting a building ready, of getting foodstuffs ready. We operate all our own concessions, so you have a separate concession company. You have a ticketing agency, a ticketing company that's handling tickets both on-site and off-site. You have a rag business, which is handling the sale of merchandise. You have an advertising company. And all of these are working at 10 o'clock in the morning. Your ground crew comes in to prepare the field. And so because the fact that you are open for business and that the public will be in and judging you on your performance, every night is opening night, you have all of these different entities coming together with one goal in mind, which is to make it a wonderful trip for the fans. So we keep it very childlike. We have toys everywhere. We have art everywhere. We have public art. We have private art in the offices. We have music piped in, and anything that we can do to keep it light, to keep it airy. We employ kids of all ages. We have my daughter, Rebecca, answering the phone a lot of the time. We have scoreboard operators that violate, child labor laws left and right, but they set a tone, and I think that when people come into one of our ballparks, they know that this is a ballpark run for them. And they can sense if there's a great deal of camaraderie and if there's companionship and people are having fun. And I think that's one of the most important elements that any business can provide, is the moment you walk in, especially in a service business, you can tell if people enjoy their work, if people are glad that you're there. And so I think that all of these things compound to make it a fun trip to the ballpark, whether you win or lose.
So how do you apply this to something more, as we envision business-like? Somebody may come to you and say, hi, I'm a tax attorney. I work at an accounting firm somewhere where we're all about a lot of file work and just a real tight office environment. How do you apply Fun is Good?
Well, I think the first thing you have to do is find someone or people of like mind. And you find a place to gather. You find a place for a coffee in the morning or for a meeting at lunch, whether it's a lunchroom. You have a place for Nerf ball or ping pong or whatever your size company and building allows for. And then, of course, I think the most important thing is that you arrange to do things outside of work, and you don't have to get 100% maximum cooperation. But you do need 3, 4, 5 people to start hanging around together outside of work. This whole idea that you keep your friends separate from your workplace, if you're going to spend all of your time working, why not hang out with the people and develop some camaraderie, develop some fun? You know, you can decorate for holidays, very simple things. You can what we use all the time is we're constantly using theme days, using the last Friday of each month. Whether we have it's Blue Jean Day, it's 70s Day. We have a kangaroo court, which fines people for those little idiosyncratic habits that drive everyone crazy. In my case, I don't leave my desk until I've sharpened all my pencils. So almost every night they break all my pencil points off, and which drives me insane. And we have tournaments outside. People are given 2 days off every month with pay to volunteer for any group that they want. If they feel that Habitat for Humanity is close to their hearts, or a Rotary and reading to kids or delivering flowers in hospitals or hospice work. Volunteer work, there's nothing that brings a company together and also creates another dimension. The problem is the workplace becomes so singularly, we take ourselves way too seriously. You should take your work seriously, but not yourself.
We're going to go to the phones. We've got a caller on the line from Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Hello. Hi, yes, you mentioned your 17-page marketing plan. Where do you start on that type of a plan?
Could you be a little more specific when you say where you start?
Well, in sense of, well, just, yeah, how do you get started on something like that?
Well, in our case, it was... because it was a baseball team, because it was independent, we designed the whole league for fan enjoyment. Player development issues, where we were going to get players, rules. Kind of we went along as we started. We used National Association, which is the governing body of minor league baseball, framework to set up the rule system. But we designed uniforms, everything that we did was basically designed around the fans' experience as we knew it. What I loved about it was we utilized people who had never worked in baseball, so they had no preconceived notions and, of course, no prejudices about the way it should be done.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so your fans are your clients, essentially.
That's correct.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to Mike Veck, who's released the book Fun is Good, How to Create Joy and Passion in Your Workplace and Career. If you have a question for him, you can call in at 333-9455 or outside the immediate area at 800-222-9455. Mike, I'd like to talk about a little bit about your upbringing. And I mentioned earlier how whether or not you intended it, you sort of followed in your father's footsteps and entered baseball, and we're having worked in both the minor leagues and the major leagues. And you talked in the book about seeing that your father was having fun, and I assume that you picked up on this when you were, you know, a pretty early age.
Yeah, I found I was raised by very joyous people. I'm one of nine children, and I remember, you know, very distinctly as a child, being advised constantly by both my mother and father that whatever I did, whatever I chose to do, I should have fun. And as we become more and more technologically complicated, for want of a better word, you know, our goal system, I think, becomes further and goes further and further adrift from our inner being and our core. And so watching this fellow who operated baseball teams, I used to stand around and watch and say, I wonder how he gets paid. And every day seemed to be chaotic in the best sense of the word. Every day seemed to be new and exciting, and he would be trading players one day and working on the scoreboard or menu items or coming up with promotions. And I watched how he seemed to function so tirelessly, especially when his guests, when fans were involved. He would take an inordinate amount of time doing what I now realize was a very sophisticated form of research. You know, he would simply ask the end user, in his case, fans coming in, what they thought, not so much so that they could tell him all the wonderful things that he was doing, but he was much more interested in complaints and indeed welcomed them. So that the man who designed the exploding scoreboard, which came from a play by William Saroyan, The Time of Your Life, was a year-long process that celebrated a home run. He went from having a little model designed after he'd seen the play by Saroyan, and then went about selling it to an advertiser, and then building this behemoth in the center field bleachers at the old Comiskey, which still exists in kind of new fashion in the new Comiskey. In short, he celebrated the passion that he felt for baseball, commingled with ideas and imagination and customer service, and it was really almost impossible not to be swayed by his joy and his energy.
Yeah, his philosophy was why not? There may have been some people that felt that an exploding scoreboard didn't make a lot of sense when it was proposed, but he made a lot of things just second nature in baseball. Not only that, but years of Harry Carey singing the seventh inning stretch on both sides of town.
Yeah, it came from very simple, I think a simple premise. Names on the back of the uniforms, for example, which, today are the norm. And back then, that was heralded as a tremendous change, a radical departure, if you will, from the way things had been done. And it came about simply because in the early days when women were starting to come to more and more sporting events, they didn't know who number 7 was, or 24, or 15. And one day a woman said, "Hey, Bill, who's number 22? Why don't you put their names on so we know who they are?" And, of course, they weren't on so that you would buy a scorecard. And my dad went home and said, this is a fairly intelligent approach. And it was the result of constantly answering his own phone. He was listed in the phone book. And he had really no interest in talking about himself. But he did have a tremendous amount of time to talk about people and their ideas.
You said in an interview that I read that you never intended to follow in your father's path, but you essentially have. I mean, do you think this was just from years of watching him, or maybe a passion for working in baseball maybe you didn't realize that you had?
No, I'll tell you exactly. I got out of school and joined a rock and roll band and played music on the road for 3 years. And my dad called me one day and said, "Let's have lunch," which was really a euphemism for we'd go to a saloon and have a couple of beers and talk about the world around us. And at the end of a really fun day, it was November of 75, he said to me, "I'm going to buy the Chicago White Sox a second time." And he'd been through so many trials, Jeff. He had structured a deal to buy the Orioles earlier that year, and the deal had fallen apart. And he said to me, and we were not particularly close as father and son. He was my father. I respected him. But I really didn't know him. I knew that he was well thought of in circles and had certainly some legendary credentials as far as the outside world was concerned, but he was just my dad. But then he hit the magic button. He said, "I'd love to have you come and work with us," the "with" being a key word. He said, "I won't pay you very much money, but you can learn a business that I think will stand you in good stead if you apply it to any business." I told him with the vanity of youth that I would stay 2 years. I stayed 6, and I never had so much fun. And it had never occurred to me that working 15-hour days and, week after week without a day off, that we were working. We were just all on a crusade, having fun. So from January of 76 until February 1st of 81, we were creating things that have changed the face of sports marketing, as they call it now, which would really give my dad a laugh. But so many of the changes that have come across the landscape were created on the south side of Chicago. It was the most wonderful experience. That's why I keep going back. I've been back 3 times since, fired every time, trying to find that same elusive quality of fun and passion.
Well, I guess this leads to a natural progression into my next question regarding what I guess several people would say led to sort of a fallout with your career there, and that's Disco Demolition Night. And what do you think that experience did as far as putting that together and then and taking you to where you are now in your career?
Well, Disco Demolition was a twi-night doubleheader rescheduled between the Chicago White Sox and the Detroit Tigers. And in 1977, we'd done a couple of disco promotions where we would haul 20 stages out and people would dance. And having spent a number of years, as I mentioned earlier, on the road playing rock and roll, we retired one evening to a saloon downtown in Chicago, and after one of these disco contests, and somebody said, wouldn't it have been a great idea if we'd had a night the next night for people who really loathe disco and called it an anti-disco night? And we all thought that was mildly entertaining and, you know, said our goodbyes. 2 years later, a Chicago disc jockey by the name of Steve Dahl blew up a disco record on the air on a very small, at that point, station WLUP in Chicago. And Jeff Schwartz called me and he said, you remember that idea about anti-disco night? And I said, yeah. And he said, there's a disc jockey in Chicago who just blew up a disco record. Maybe we could have some fun. And so I contacted Steve Dahl when he got off the air and asked him if he'd like to come to Comiskey Park and try it. And he said, well, I don't know if it'll draw any people live, but I'm going to open a shopping center or some such in Indiana in a week or two, and we'll give it a shot. So on July 12th, 100,000 people showed up to blow up a disco record. We had 60,000 people in Comiskey Park. We had 40,000 people outside. Between games, we put a stick of dynamite in with 15,000. Donna Summers, Casey and the Sunshine Band, and BG Records, and blew them sky high. And I just didn't recognize at the time that the very top was my career. And we forfeited the second game, which was only the fourth forfeiture in the history of baseball. But the real lesson that I learned was I didn't know what a slow news day meant. And the next day was, fittingly, Friday the 13th. And there were four pages in one of the metros, in the Sun-Times, and five and a half in the Tribune. And because it was only the fourth forfeiture in the history of baseball, it brought, shall we say, some ringing criticism down around my ears. And it taught me a great deal about slow news days, and the fact is that the sun comes out the next day. But it made me virtually unemployable at the major league level for a lot of years. That was tough getting over.
But your dad, as your dad said, it was a promotion that worked too well.
Yeah, it's funny because people are always waiting for the punchline. But the fact was that Bill Veeck understood exactly what had happened all too well, is that you work hard. Obviously, I had no idea. I thought if we drew 35,000 people, I'd be a wizard. And I was 28. I had no idea that younger people felt this strongly, but I'd kind of lost touch. And it was interesting from the standpoint that people would say, well, these are not baseball fans. Well, of course they weren't baseball fans. Your job as a promoter of baseball is 35% of your audience will come if you do nothing. But it's the 65% that you have to try to fill those seats by attracting individual market demographics and the like. And I just didn't think that blowing up a BG record would ever do that.
We're talking with Mike Veeck about his book, Fun is Good, How to Create Joy and Passion in Your Workplace and Career. And if you'd like to call in with a question for Mike, we have a couple of copies of the book that we're giving away. The phone number 333-9455 in and around Champaign-Urbana. And anyone else who can hear us, 800-222-9455. You talk a little bit in one of your chapters about dusting yourself off and finding a new approach, whether or not it's something like Disco Demolition that drives you away, or maybe just the major league experience that hasn't gone maybe the way you would like it to. Could you talk a bit about how you go about doing that, reinventing yourself and finding a career change?
Yeah, I think sometimes, Chef, that we fail to recognize several signposts, you know, in our life as we go along. And one of the ones that intrigues me the most is 80% of the people in this country say that they welcome change. And of that 80%, 20% actually can deal with change. Change is something that no matter how much lip service we give, that we as a working country, as a working people, as people building futures, you know, we're uncomfortable with change. And in my business, for example, in the baseball business, change is the order of the day. Dealing with it is a necessity. You know, every night is a new game. You win, you lose, you have so many people, you get so many base hits, you sell so many hot dogs, you park so many cars, and then it's erased and you do it again the next day. And because we're afraid of change, it makes failure come along and have this tremendous foreboding shadow that, gosh, if I'm not successful as I work towards my goal, whatever that is, if I have the audacity to fail, what will people think? And we set goals that really hold no water and that really hold no psychological return, no feeding for us, because we're so caught up in what the goals are, we forget that the trip along the way is what's really the sweetness. And people, I think, get locked into jobs that they hate, or that they are even worse than having the passion enough to hate them, that they kind of look at and say, eh, I could take it or leave it. And the idea that we have to settle for anything, that the human spirit, as wonderful as it is, and as flexible and as resilient as human beings are, the idea that we should settle for something because it pays well, I think is diametrically opposed to what makes us creative and energetic in the first place. So I think change is something that we all have to deal with constantly and be more comfortable in failure. There is life after failure. I think we take ourselves way too seriously. If I don't go to work for the next week, all six of our minor league teams are going to run better because I have wonderful people in place. They are better at their jobs than I am. I never try to hire yes men or women or lackeys. I try to hire people who question all the time, who fight, who want to know, why are you doing it this way? Isn't this a better way to do it? And I think it all comes from how we deal with failure and with change.
We got a caller on the line, line four calling from Indiana. Hello, you're on the air with Mike Beck.
Hello. Well, I would have to say hear to this last few statements you made. Took me a long time to realize that a misplaced goal can really screw up your life. Then once you finally accept, you know, that that's not what you really wanted to do in the first place, you know, it's sort of a huge cosmic joke. I have two things. One is just sort of a comment. I'm not a baseball fan anymore. I was as a youngster, you know, you almost forced to be in the Midwest. My interests really were, you know, collecting butterflies and things like that. But I did the baseball thing and played ball and wasn't too bad of a player for the group I was in. And I sure remember us talking about your father. I remember one time he just sort of come up, well, what's Vic up to now, you know? And as young kids, he was an interesting role model. And I'm sure glad to see that at least one of his sons has turned out to be, you know, appropriate person for, you know, for handling baseball and PR as far as that goes. And the next one is, if you don't want to answer, it's fine with me, but what do you think about the on the horizon rules and regulations in regard to drugs with the players? That's one thing that I finally, you know, just said to hell with it and stopped paying any attention to baseball. When I saw these guys, you know, over a period of time, you know, become almost mammoths, you know, and it's too bad that you have this thing with people my age who saw guys hit the ball who at the most probably may have done speed, I don't know, but certainly drank a lot, I know that. and set certain records, and now, you know, it's just sort of like up in the air. You know, it's too bad for the game. I don't know what the kids think today, but, you know, it was an appropriate total role model when I was young. Thanks a lot.
Well, first, I appreciate the kind words about my dad. He was a terrific role model, although he'd have slapped me for saying that already. But the fact is that the steroid issue points to the two problems that I think we have right now in baseball, specifically Major League Baseball, that the minor leagues are attempting to be antidotes for, and one is the leadership. I think that it's time for us to go outside the game and to find a commissioner who has, if not dictatorial powers, the power to exercise his or her rulings in terms of the best interests of baseball. Rudy Giuliani would be a great commissioner of baseball. The second thing is that we don't have a relationship between the players and the kids who attend ball games the way there were when the gentleman who just called in. He said, when I was young, I was a baseball fan. They were role models. What he's really saying is they were accessible. So that accessibility to the players, like NASCAR is the largest spectator sport in this country, soccer, of course, in the world. But NASCAR drivers are accessible to their fans. And that's something we have to get back to. I think that what you're going to find is Selig has kicked back to the union the idea of drug testing, and they will eventually adopt, I think, the Olympic Committee's no tolerance or zero tolerance. But until then, over the next 5 to 10 years, I think it'll be whittled down so that there'll be two offenses and out. It's a very difficult problem because the union can't give up, you know, the gains that it's made. The fact is that Congress doesn't have any business policing baseball any more than they do White Castle employees. So it's a difficult problem, and if you're going to ban players from steroid use, you have to give a period of time. We have a much stronger policy in minor league baseball than they do in major league baseball. We also check for cocaine and additives of that nature, which amphetamines, which they don't have. So I think you'll see a change in the next 3 years to 5 years dramatically, and then with the next wave of players, there'll be zero tolerance.
You talked about the commissioner, and one of the promotions I wanted to bring up that you had Taiwan on for Bud Night, which followed that All-Star game a couple of years ago that ended in a tie and got a lot of people upset with commissioner. Help fill me in here on the promotion. I believe you could either sit on Don Fear or Bud Selig.
Well, actually, there were two separate and distinct, but both inspired by the tie. The first one was we had ties literally made up overnight with Commissioner Selig's visage on them, and gave them out mostly to the media because we thought it was fun and, more importantly, points out, you know, something that really did make the fans irate. And I think that's the best promotions kind of laugh at ourselves but have a serious side to them. And I think that was a way to deal with something that we all looked at and said, gosh, you know, the beauty of this game is somebody always wins. The agony is someone always loses. The second thing was work stoppages not being called strikes drive fans crazy. When you go to work, if employees are unhappy, they strike. They don't stage work stoppages. That's a word that we hate in baseball. So, you know, we hate the word strike, so we call them work stoppages. So we simply said vote by sitting down. We put Donald Fear on one side of the seat cushion, and we put the commissioner on the other side. In an appropriate moment, we had everyone sit down and theoretically vote on who they thought was at fault for the latest strike in baseball, and it doesn't make you popular in the league office or in the commissioner's office, but the fans seem to like it, and more importantly, they understand it.
We're talking to Mike Vec on his book, Fun is Good. And again, if you'd like to join in the conversation, 333-9455 and, or 800-222-9455 outside of the immediate area. It seems like you're in a real win-win situation with some of your promotions. Maybe some of them, some will criticize, have gone too far, but you certainly get the publicity if something may, if you run something with the risk of offending a few people.
Yeah, I do think that you have to make people think. I mean, we did an Enron night in Portland, which I felt very strongly about. We had, and we were owned by, we were a subsidiary of Enron, PGE Park in Portland, Oregon. But we had shredders at the gates, and we sold tickets for twice the face value. And the next day, we announced an attendance in a ballpark that seats only 19,000. We announced 182,000 or some such nonsense, and then adjusted it down the next day, and we milked it for 2 or 3 days. That was a promotion that was designed specifically for the media to get some attention. Minor league baseball is no different than a drugstore on the corner. It's very difficult to come up with ideas to get media coverage. And so we break a promotion down into its basic elements. One, will it get us some attention, or two, will it draw us people? And we design them that way. When they fail, you never start out to do that, to offend people. But you do try to walk that line to create an edge. And, you know, when you fall over or on your face, as I have so many times, if people know that your heart is in it and that you're trying, they give you some leeway and they let you know when they want them canceled. I did Voodoo Night one night in Charleston, South Carolina, and I thought it was hilarious because we were playing Savannah. Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil had been riding the bestseller list for 104 weeks. We gave away a little, or we were going to give away a little voodoo dolls. And the thing was that even though it was Friday the 13th, it was also Good Friday. I'm Catholic. It didn't offend me, but it certainly did people, and we canceled it after 2.5 days of pretty good fire, shall we say, from both the fans and the press.
Do you think sometimes, too, there's just a really obvious promotion that that some related nearby business near one of your towns where your teams are located are avoiding? You had one involving a funeral home, I think.
Yeah, that one, that's funny. You really have done your research. I'm very appreciative for that. The funeral home was morally safer from 60 Minutes. Some years ago came and did a story on the St. Paul Saints because we operate 7 miles from the Metrodome where the Twins, of course, play Major League Baseball, and we've sold every ticket to every game for a dozen years. And one of the things he couldn't get over was at the gate as you leave, it says, McAllister Smith Funeral Home. Drive carefully, we can wait. And he's training his camera on that while telling me that, don't I think that's a little tasteless? And I said, no, I'm kind of pragmatic about death. I look at it as part of life. It's a nice reminder as people go simply to drive carefully, and you have a little fun. You know, if it was good enough for Martin Heidegger as a being towards death, it's good enough for me. So we designed a promotion in Charleston to give away a funeral, and I was rubbing my hands in glee. I thought, this will absolutely get some people upset, and we'll get some coverage. The reverse happened is that we had a couple hundred entries, people who filled in. The premise was, how would you like to be eulogized in 250 words or less? And people sent some of the most beautiful prose, if you will. And the winner of the contest, and we gave away a, you know, a $6,500 funeral, to a lovely woman who was in hospice care, who wrote this absolutely mind-boggling eulogy. It was a lovely recounting of her life, and we got all kinds of awards for such a forward-thinking promotion. So I don't know whether that succeeded or failed. I guess it worked well on one level and failed miserably on another.
Let's talk a little bit about the product on the field. We've just got just a few minutes left. I guess the biggest name that associated with your time with the St. Paul Saints is Daryl Strawberry, and you giving him another chance to one last bout with the major leagues.
Yeah, there was a because the St. Paul Saints had sold out, and because I'd signed Jack Morris that year, and Leon Durham had played, Bull Durham, in our inaugural year. Kevin Millar of the Red Sox won a championship last year, had played in the early years. And when Daryl was attempting a comeback, nobody in baseball would sign him. And his agent called me and said, would you have some interest in Daryl? And at first, I have to be honest, I was hypocritical to the Nines, and I said, no, I've worked very hard to build this family atmosphere, and luckily my wife Libby, when I hung up the phone, said, you're really a hypocrite. You came through that same terrain yourself. You spent time in 12-step programs, and now you won't turn around and extend to someone. And I was angry at Libby, and I was embarrassed in front of her. And the next day I called Daryl's representative back, and I said, why does he want to play in St. Paul? And the gentleman said, because he knows that you sell out already and that you won't use him to sell tickets. You don't need him to sell tickets, and maybe he could get himself straight. And Daryl Strawberry hit 18 home runs in 29 days. I sold him to the Yankees. He hit 3 home runs in 2 games at Columbus. He went on to hit 11 home runs for the Yankees in the championship year of 96. And he had 2 things that he had to do. He had to stay clean, and he had to sign autographs for kids. And my favorite Daryl Strawberry story is he came in after about a week, and he said, you know, Mike, I never realized how much I love to play this game. And I said, you know, Daryl, this may come as a shock to you, but a lot of us will never know the feeling of a 12-year-old kid coming with a pencil, you know, and a crumpled piece of paper asking for our signature. And that's a privilege. It's not this responsibility or something that should wear you down. It's something that should lift your spirit, that someone would think enough of your talent to come and make that request. And he was a great citizen the time that he was in St. Paul.
What's it like working with Bill Murray?
Just imagine what a board of directors meeting is like with Bill Murray, Jimmy Buffett, and Jimmy Fallon. It's insanity. Bill's a great ball fan. Obviously, he's a Cub fan. I'm a lifelong White Sox fan, so it creates some pretty good friction, if you will. But he has a great eye for the game. His idea actually led to Nobody Night. He has a wonderful promotional sense. He's a very bright, scary bright man, and he's a huge baseball fan. So he tours all of our clubs once a year if his shooting schedule for movies allows it. And he teaches the most important lesson, I think, in our whole group, and that is, after every game, he signs autographs for every kid, no matter how long it takes. And I've seen him sit 2 hours, 3 hours after a ball game and sign until every kid has an autograph. And that is a great lesson for young players coming up or guys who are hitting 230 and have a groin pull, is that he's a very active contributor. Well, there was just a story. They airbrushed most of us out on the picture on the finance section of Newsweek, but he survived. Maybe that's because he's a movie star.
And we need to wrap this up. Any last advice in the 30 seconds or less you can provide to anyone out there who might be unhappy in their career to apply fun is good?
Yeah, have fun. And if you can't have fun, change jobs. Take a chance. I was 40 years old, broke, and threw it all to the wind because I knew it was too short, and I was already halfway through it. and take the afternoon off and see. It'll still be there tomorrow.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate and really enjoyed the book.
Well, thank you so much, and it was just wonderful. Take care.
You too. Mike Vec has been our guest, the son of Bill Vec and the operator of six minor league baseball teams, on his book, Fun is Good, How to Create Joy and Passion in Your Workplace and Career. It's published by Rodale. You're listening to The Afternoon Magazine. Joining us next is Todd Gleason with a look at our afternoon market report.
Thanks very much, Jeff. From the Chicago Board of Trade on this Thursday afternoon, futures were higher in the wheat, the corn, and the soybeans. In fact, soybeans pushing into new contract highs for the day. July futures in the wheat pit, where we always start, had a high today of $3.39.5. Their low price at $3.26. A settlement 7.5 cents higher at $3.37.75 for the July wheat. That's your harvest month, which should ensue across a portion of the United States here in the next couple of weeks. And most think that will put pressure on the marketplace, but certainly not today. September futures $3.48. The high, the low at $3.35.5. Settlement price at $3.47.25. They were up 7 cents. And December contract at $3.58 high, low at $3.46. Settlement there at $3.56.5. They were up 6.75. March futures 6.5 higher, $3.67.5. The high for the day, the low at $3.55, and a settlement price at $3.66.5. Once again, that March wheat contract up 6.5 cents. May futures for next year $3.70. The high, the low at $3.65. Settlement price at $3.69 even. And they finished the day 6 cents higher. From the corn pit, July futures like this on the day, $2.25.5. The high, the low at $2.20.5, settled at $2.25 for the July corn, up 2.25. September, $2.33.25 high, low at $2.28.5, settlement price at $2.33, up 2.25. And December contract, $2.42, the high, the low at $2.37.75, settlement price at $2.41.75, up 2 for the day. March futures, $2.50, the high, the low at $2.46, settlement price at $2.49.75, up 2.25. And the May corn up 1.75, $2.54, the high, the low at $2.51, settlement price at $2.53.75. Once again, the May corn up 1.75 for the day. July corn, $2.58.75, the high, the low at $2.54.5, and a settlement price at $2.58.5, up 2 cents. Should be fun when we talk with Dan Zwicker this afternoon of AgriVisor Services out of Bloomington, Illinois. Been the resident bull since January for the commodities. He'll get a chance on a good update to talk about his ideas of the marketplace. Be sure to tune in at 6 after the hour, 2 o'clock, for the closing market report this afternoon, when we'll talk with Mr. Zwicker of AgriVisor Services. July oats for the day, $1.38.5, the high, the low at $1.37. Low settlement price there at $1.38.25. They were up 3/4. September oats, $1.42.5 high, low at $1.41, and a settlement price at $1.42.25, up 1 cent for the day. From the soy complex now, beans were up 9.5 cents in that nearby July contract. The high today, 77.5, the low at 63.5, and a settlement price at $6.76, up 9.5 cents for the July soybeans. August, 6.78, the high, the low at 63.5, settled 6.76.75. They were up 10.75 for the day. And September futures, 6.76, the high, the low at 6.63. Settlement at 6.74.5, up 10 cents. November futures in the bean pit, 6.77.5, the high, the low at 6.61.5. Settled 6.76.5, up 11 for the day. And January futures, 6.77.5, the high there as well. The low at $6.63, settled at 6.76.5, the same as the November's. They were up 10.25, though, in the January's. March futures, 6.72, the high, the low at 6.63, settled 6.71.5, and they were up 5.25 for the day. Bean meal futures down, July contract, 2.11 even, the high, the low at $206.50, settled 2.10.30, up $2.60. The August up 3.40 for the day, with the settlement price at $210.40, the high at 2.11, the low at 206.70. From the bean oil pit, July futures 53 cents higher, 23.78. The settlement price with a high of 23.86 and a low at 23.33. And the August bean oil, 23.90, the high, the low at 23.40, settled at 23.82. And they were up 49 for the day. From the Mercantile Exchange, let's check in and see how the numbers settled there for the day. Feeder cattle, the May contract, 7.5 cents higher, 111.10, the settlement price, the high at 111.15 and the low at 111 even. August feeder cattle were down 2.5 cents. 111.45, the high, the low at 110.60, settled 110.77 and a half. And the September futures, 110.50, the high, the low at 109.80, settled at $110, even 100 weight. And they were off a nickel for the day. May feeder cattle, rather June feeder cattle for the day, 84.92 and a half, the high, the low at 84.35, settlement price at 84.60. They finished unchanged. And the August feeder cattle, 84.55 for the high, the low at 83.72 and a half, settlement price there at 84.07 and a half, and they were unchanged as well. June live hogs now, $72.15 the high, the low at 70.90, settled at 71.10. They were down 55 for the day. In July futures, 71.82 and a half on the high, the low at $70.70, settled 70.80. They were down 20. August contract, 70.55, the high, the low at 69.55, settled at 69.85. They were down 22 and a half. In the October futures, 60.85, the high, the low at 59.75, settlement price at 59.82 and a half, and they were off 32 and a half cents. Before we get to the bellies, just a quick note, if you're looking for something to do on this Memorial Day weekend, stay tuned to the closing market report about 20 after the hour. I think there may be something in the neighborhood you might be interested to go do in Atlanta, Illinois. So stay with us for the closing market report this afternoon. I hope you find it interesting. And once again, our discussion with Dan Zwicker should be a doozy this afternoon. Bellies today, $3 lower. That's down the limit. $79.15 the high in the July. Low at 76, settled at $76 even. Once again, they were down the $3 limit. The frozen August pork bellies down the $3 limit as well. They had a high of $77.15, a low at $73.55, and they settled on that low at $73.55.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, helping to create a storehouse of possibilities and products from a single seed. ADM, resourceful by nature.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
David Lawroth of Brisbane, Australia writes, "Dear Dr. Science, how come no matter how carefully I shave, 10 minutes later I find a couple of hairs that are far too long to have been missed by my razor?"
You're witnessing retractable hairs, the result of evolutionary adaptation to fur-seeking predators. Yes, when Neolithic man saw a fanged barber seal approaching, his long, luxuriant body hairs were sucked back inside, leaving his far less attractive and certainly filthy skin visible to the hungry seal. If you'd like to force those hairs back inside your own body for good, you have only to sufficiently frighten yourself. Unlike most hair removal schemes, a healthy dose of sheer terror will often result in permanent baldness. May I suggest viewing Scorsese's remake of Cape Fear? I haven't had a haircut since I last viewed that pic.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's.